until we come back up again."
She took the end of Buckbeak's rope and tied it securely around the nearest tree, then sat down on the dry ground, arms around her knees.
"Harry, there's something I don't understand. Why didn't the Dementors get Sirius? I remember them coming, and then I think I passed out. There were so many of them."
Harry sat down, too. He explained what he'd seen, how, as the nearest Dementor had lowered its mouth to Harry's, a large silver something had come galloping across the lake and forced the Dementors to retreat. Hermione's mouth was slightly open by the time Harry had finished.
"But what was it?"
"There's only one thing it could have been, to make the Dementors go," said Harry. "A real Patronus, a powerful one."
"But who conjured it?"
Harry didn't say anything. He was thinking back to the person he'd seen on the other bank of the lake. He knew who he thought it had been, but how could it have been?
"Didn't you see what they looked like?"
said Hermione eagerly.
"Was it one of the teachers?"
"No," said Harry. "He wasn't a teacher."
"But it must have been a really powerful wizard to drive all those Dementors away. If the Patronus was shining so brightly, didn't it light him up? Couldn't you see?"
"Yeah, I saw him," said Harry slowly. "But maybe I imagined it. I wasn't thinking straight. I passed out right afterward."
"Who did you think it was?"
"I think..." Harry swallowed, knowing how strange this was going to sound. "I think it was my dad." Harry glanced up at Hermione and saw that her mouth was fully open now. She was gazing at him with a mixture of alarm and pity.
"Harry, your dad's, well, dead," she said quietly. "I know that," said Harry quickly. "You think you saw his ghost?"
"I don't know. No, he looks solid.
But then..."
"Maybe I was seeing things," said Harry. "But from what I could see, it looked like him. I've got photos of him." Hermione was still looking at him as though worried about his sanity.
"I know it sounds crazy," said Harry flatly.
He turned to look at Buckbeak, who was digging his beak into the ground, apparently searching for worms. But he wasn't really watching Buckbeak. He was thinking about his father, and about his father's three oldest friends, Moony, Wormtail, Padfoot, and Prongs. Had all four of them been out on the grounds tonight? Wormtail had reappeared this evening when everyone had thought he was dead. Was it so impossible his father had done the same? Had he been seeing things across the lake? The figure had been too far away to see distinctly, yet he had felt sure, for a moment, before he'd lost consciousness. The leaves overhead rustled faintly in the breeze. The moon drifted in and out of sight behind the shifting clouds. Hermione sat with her face turned toward the willow, waiting. And then, at last, after over an hour,
"Here we come,"
Hermione whispered. She and Harry got to their feet. Buckbeak raised his head. They saw Lupin, Ron, and Pettigrew clambering awkwardly out of the hole in the roots. Then came Hermione, then the unconscious Snape, drifting weirdly upward. Next came Harry and Black. They all began to walk toward the castle. Harry's heart was starting to beat very fast. He glanced up at the sky. Any moment now, that cloud was going to move aside and show the moon.
"Harry,"
Hermione muttered, as though she knew exactly what he was thinking.
"We've got to stay put. We mustn't be seen. There's nothing we can do."
"So we're just going to let Pettigrew escape all over again," said Harry quietly.
"How do we expect to find a rat in the dark?" snapped Hermione. "There's nothing we can do. We came back to help Sirius. We're not supposed to be doing anything else."
"All right." The moon slid out from behind its cloud. They saw the tiny figures across the grounds stop. Then they saw movement.
"There goes Lupin,"
Hermione whispered.
"He's transforming."
"Hermione," said Harry suddenly,
"we've got to move." "We mustn't. I keep telling you not to interfere. Lupin's going to run into the forest right at us."
Hermione gasped.
"Quick,"
she moaned, dashing to untie Buckbeak.
"Quick, where are we going to go? Where are we going to hide? The Dementors will be coming any moment." "Back to Hagrid's," Harry said. "It's empty now. Come on."
They ran as fast as they could, Buckbeak cantering along behind them. They could hear the werewolf howling behind them. The cabin was in sight. Harry skidded to the door, wrenched it open, and Hermione and Buckbeak flashed past him. Harry threw himself in after them and bolted the door. Fang, the boarhound, barked loudly.
"Shh, Fang, it's us,"
said Hermione, hurrying over and scratching his ears to quieten him.
"That was really close," she said to Harry.
"Yeah."
Harry was looking out of the window. It was much harder to see what was going on from here. Buckbeak seemed very happy to find himself back inside Hagrid's house. He lay down in front of the fire, folded his wings contentedly, and seemed ready for a good nap.
"I think I'd better go outside again, you know," said Harry slowly. "I can't see what's going on. We won't know when it's time."
Hermione looked up. Her expression was suspicious.
"I'm not going to try and interfere," said Harry quickly, "but if we don't see what's going on, how are we going to know when it's time to rescue Sirius?" "Well, okay then, I'll wait here with Buckbeak, but Harry, be careful, there's a werewolf out there, and the Dementors."
Harry stepped outside again and edged around the cabin. He could hear yelping in the distance. That meant the Dementors were closing in on Sirius. He and Hermione would be running to him any moment. Harry stared out toward the lake, his heart doing a kind of drum roll in his chest. Whoever had sent that Patronus would be appearing at any moment. For a fraction of a second he stood, irresolute, in front of Hagrid's door.
"You must not be seen."
But he didn't want to be seen. He wanted to do the seeing. He had to know. And there were the Dementors. They were emerging out of the darkness from every direction, gliding around the edges of the lake. They were moving away from where Harry stood, to the opposite bank. He wouldn't have to get near them. Harry began to run. He had no thought in his head except his father. If it was him, if it really was him, he had to know, had to find out. The lake was coming nearer and nearer, but there was no sign of anybody. On the opposite bank he could see tiny glimmers of silver, his own attempts at a Patronus. There was a bush at the very edge of the water. Harry threw himself behind it, peering desperately through the leaves. On the opposite bank, the glimmers of silver were suddenly extinguished. A terrified excitement shot through him at any moment now.
"Come on," he muttered, staring about. "Where are you? Dad, come on."
But no one came. Harry raised his head to look at the circle of Dementors across the lake. One of them was lowering its hood. It was time for the rescuer to appear, but no one was coming to help this time.
And then it hit him. He understood. He hadn't seen his father. He had seen himself.
Harry flung himself out from behind the bush and pulled out his wand.
"Expecto Patronum!" he yelled, and out of the end of his wand burst not a shapeless cloud of mist, but a blinding, dazzling silver animal.
He screwed up his eyes, trying to see what it was. It looked like a horse. It was galloping silently away from him, across the black surface of the lake. He saw it lower its head and charge at the swarming Dementors. Now it was galloping around and around the black shapes on the ground, and the Dementors were falling back, scattering, retreating into the darkness. They were gone. The Patronus turned. It was cantering back toward Harry across the still surface of the water. It wasn't a horse. It wasn't a unicorn either. It was a stag. It was shining brightly as the moon above. It was coming back to him. It stopped on the bank. Its hooves made no mark on the soft ground as it stared at Harry with its large silver eyes. Slowly, it bowed its antlered head, and Harry realized.
"Prongs," he whispered.
But as his trembling fingertips stretched toward the creature, it vanished. Harry stood there, hands still outstretched. Then, with a great leap of his heart, he heard hooves behind him. He whirled around and saw Hermione dashing toward him, dragging Buckbeak behind her.
"What did you do?"
she said fiercely. You said you were only going to keep a lookout.
I just saved all our lives, said Harry. Get behind here, behind this bush. I'll explain.
Hermione listened to what had just happened with her mouth open yet again.
Did anyone see you?
Yes, haven't you been listening? I saw me, but I thought I was my dad. It's okay.
Harry, I can't believe it.
You conjured up a Patronus that drove away all those Dementors?
That's very, very advanced magic.
I knew I could do it this time, said Harry, because I'd already done it. Does that make sense?
I don't know. Harry, look at Snape.
Together they peered around the bush to the other bank. Snape had regained consciousness. He was conjuring stretchers and lifting the limp forms of Harry, Hermione, and Black onto them. A fourth stretcher, no doubt bearing Ron, was already floating at his side. Then, one held out in front of him, he moved them away toward the castle.
Right, it's nearly time, said Hermione tensely, looking at her watch. We've got about 45 minutes until Dumbledore locks the door to the hospital wing. We've got to rescue Sirius and get back into the ward before anybody realizes we're missing.
They waited, watching the moving clouds reflected in the lake, while the bush next to them whispered in the breeze. Buckbeak, bored, was ferreting for worms again.
Do you reckon he's up there yet? Said Harry, checking his watch.
He looked up at the castle and began counting the windows to the right of the west tower.
Look, Hermione whispered. Who's that? Someone's coming back out of the castle.
Harry stared through the darkness. The man was hurrying across the grounds, towards one of the entrances. Something shiny glinted in his belt.
McNair, said Harry, the executioner. He's gone to get the Dementors. This is it, Hermione.
Hermione put her hands on Buckbeak's back, and Harry gave her a leg up. Then he placed his foot on one of the lower branches of the bush and climbed up in front of her. He pulled Buckbeak's rope back over his neck and tied it to the other side of his collar like reins.
Ready? He whispered to Hermione. You'd better hold on to me.
He nudged Buckbeak's sides with his heels. Buckbeak soared straight into the dark air. Harry gripped his flanks with his knees, feeling the great wings rising powerfully beneath them. Hermione was holding Harry very tight around the waist. He could hear her muttering, "Oh, no, I don't like this. Ooh, I really don't like this." Harry urged Buckbeak forward. They were gliding quietly toward the upper floors of the castle. Harry pulled hard on the left-hand side of the rope, and Buckbeak turned. Harry was trying to count the windows flashing past.
"Woo!"
he said, pulling backward as hard as he could. Buckbeak slowed down, and they found themselves at a stop, unless you counted the fact that they kept rising up and down several feet as the hippogriff beat his wings to remain airborne.
"He's there,"
Harry said, spotting Sirius as they rose up beside the window. He reached out, and as Buckbeak's wings fell, was able to tap sharply on the glass. Black looked up. Harry saw his jaw drop. He leapt from his chair, hurried to the window, and tried to open it, but it was locked.
"Stand back!"
Hermione called to him, and she took out her wand, still gripping the back of Harry's robes with her left hand.
"Alohomora!"
The window sprang open.
"How? How?"
said Black weakly, staring at the hippogriff.
"Get on, there's not much time," said Harry, gripping Buckbeak firmly on either side of his sleek neck to hold him steady. "You've got to get out of here. The Dementors are coming. McNair's gone to get them."
Black placed a hand on either side of the window frame and heaved his head and shoulders out of it. It was very lucky he was so thin. In seconds, he had managed to fling one leg over Buckbeak's back and pull himself onto the hippogriff behind Hermione.
"Okay, Buckbeak, up," said Harry, shaking the rope. "Up to the tower. Come on."
The hippogriff gave one sweep of its mighty wings, and they were soaring upward again, high as the top of the west tower. Buckbeak landed with a clatter on the battlements, and Harry and Hermione slid off him at once.
"Sirius, you'd better go, quick," Harry panted. "They'll reach Flitwick's office any moment. They'll find out you're gone."
Buckbeak pawed the ground, tossing his sharp head.
"What happened to the other boy, Ron?"
croaked Sirius.
"He's going to be okay. He's still out of it, but Madame Pomfrey says she'll be able to make him better. Quick, go!"
but Black was still staring down at Harry.
"How can I ever thank—"
"Go!"
Harry and Hermione shouted together. Black wheeled Buckbeak around, facing the open sky.
"We'll see each other again," he said. "You are truly your father's son, Harry."
He squeezed Buckbeak's sides with his heels. Harry and Hermione jumped back as the enormous wings rose once more. The hippogriff took off into the air. He and his rider became smaller and smaller as Harry gazed after them. Then a cloud drifted across the moon. They were gone. Chapter 22. Owl Post Again.
"Harry!"
Hermione was tugging at his sleeve, staring at her watch.
"We've got exactly 10 minutes to get back down to the hospital wing without anybody seeing us, before Dumbledore locks the door."
"Okay," said Harry, wrenching his gaze from the sky. "Let's go."
They slipped through the doorway behind them and down a tightly spiraling stone staircase. As they reached the bottom of it, they heard voices. They flattened themselves against the wall and listened. It sounded like Fudge and Snape. They were walking quickly along the corridor at the foot of the staircase.
"Only hope Dumbledore's not going to make difficulties," Snape was saying. "The kiss will be performed immediately.
As soon as McNair returns with the Dementors, this whole Black affair has been highly embarrassing. I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to informing the Daily Prophet that we've got him at last. I dare say they'll want to interview you, Snape. And once young Harry's back in his right mind, I expect he'll want to tell the Prophet exactly how you saved him."
Harry clenched his teeth. He caught a glimpse of Snape's smirk as he and Fudge passed Harry and Hermione's hiding place. Their footsteps died away. Harry and Hermione waited a few moments to make sure they'd really gone, then started to run in the opposite direction. Down one staircase, then another, along a new corridor. Then they heard a cackling ahead.
"Peeves," Harry muttered, grabbing Hermione's wrist. "In here."
They tore into a deserted classroom to their left, just in time. Peeves seemed to be bouncing along the corridor in boisterous good spirits, laughing his head off.
"Ooh, he's horrible," whispered Hermione, her ear to the door. "I bet he's all excited because the Dementors are going to finish off Sirius."
She checked her watch.
3 minutes, Harry."
They waited until Peeves's gloating voice had faded into the distance, then slid back out of the room and broke into a run again.
"Hermione, what'll happen if we don't get back inside before Dumbledore locks the door?"
Harry panted.
"I don't want to think about it,"
Hermione moaned, checking her watch again.
1 minute."
They had reached the end of the corridor with the hospital wing entrance.
"Okay, I can hear Dumbledore," said Hermione tensely. "Come on, Harry."
They crept along the corridor. The door opened. Dumbledore's back appeared.
"I am going to lock you in," they heard him saying. "It is 5 minutes to midnight. Miss Granger, 3 turns should do it. Good luck."
Dumbledore backed out of the room, closed the door, and took out his wand to magically lock it. Panicking, Harry and Hermione ran forward. Dumbledore looked up, and a wide smile appeared under the long silver moustache.
"Well,"
he said quietly.
"We did it," said Harry breathlessly. "Sirius has gone, and Buckbeak."
Dumbledore beamed at them.
"Well done. I think—"
He listened intently for any sound within the hospital wing.
"Yes, I think you've gone too. Get inside. I'll lock you in."
Harry and Hermione slipped back inside the dormitory. It was empty except for Ron, who was still lying motionless in the end bed. As the lock clicked behind them, Harry and Hermione crept back to their own beds, Hermione tucking the time-turner back under her robes. A moment later, Madame Pomfrey came striding back out of her office.
"Did I hear the headmaster leaving? Am I allowed to look after my patients now?"
She was in a very bad mood. Harry and Hermione thought it best to accept their chocolate quietly. Madame Pomfrey stood over them, making sure they ate it. But Harry could hardly swallow. He and Hermione were waiting, listening, their nerves jangling. And then, as they both took a fourth piece of chocolate from Madame Pomfrey, they heard a distant roar of fury echoing from somewhere above them.
"What was that?"
said Madame Pomfrey in alarm. Now they could hear angry voices growing louder and louder. Madame Pomfrey was staring at the door.
"Really? They'll wake everybody up. What do they think they're doing?"
Harry was trying to hear what the voices were saying. They were drawing nearer.
"He must have disapparated, Severus. We should have left somebody in the room with him. When this gets out—"
"He didn't disapparate!"
Snape roared, now very close at hand.
"You can't apparate or disapparate inside this castle. This has something to do with Potter."
"Severus, be reasonable. Harry has been locked up."
Bam! The door of the hospital wing burst open. Fudge, Snape, and Dumbledore came striding into the ward. Dumbledore alone looked calm. Indeed, he looked as though he was quite enjoying himself. Fudge appeared angry, but Snape was beside himself.
"Out with it, Potter!" he bellowed. "What did you do?"
"Professor Snape!" shrieked Madame Pomfrey. "Control yourself!"
"See here, Snape, be reasonable," said Fudge. "This door's been locked. We just saw—"
"They helped him escape. I know it!"
Snape howled, pointing at Harry and Hermione. His face was twisted. Spit was flying from his mouth.
"Calm down, man," Fudge barked. "You're talking nonsense."
"You don't know Potter," shrieked Snape. "He did it. I know he did it."
"That will do, Severus," said Dumbledore quietly. "Think about what you are saying. This door has been locked since I left the ward 10 minutes ago. Madame Pomfrey, have these students left their beds?"
"Of course not,"
said Madame Pomfrey, bristling.
"I would have heard them."
"Well, there you have it, Severus," said Dumbledore calmly. "Unless you are suggesting that Harry and Hermione are able to be in two places at once, I'm afraid I don't see any point in troubling them further."
Snape stood there, seething, staring from Fudge, who looked thoroughly shocked at his behavior, to Dumbledore, whose eyes were twinkling behind his glasses. Snape whirled about, robes swishing behind him, and stormed out of the ward.
"Fellow seems quite unbalanced," said Fudge, staring after him. "I'd watch out for him if I were you, Dumbledore."
"Oh, he's not unbalanced," said Dumbledore quietly. "He's just suffered a severe disappointment."
"He's not the only one," puffed Fudge. "The Daily Prophet's going to have a field day. We had Black cornered, and he slipped through our fingers yet again. All it needs now is for the story of that Hippogriff's escape to get out, and I'll be a laughingstock. Well, I'd better go and notify the Ministry."
"And the Dementors?" said Dumbledore. "They'll be removed from the school, I trust."
"Oh, yes, they'll have to go," said Fudge, running his fingers distractedly through his hair. "Never dreamt they'd attempt to administer the kiss on an innocent boy. Completely out of control. No, I'll have them packed off back to Azkaban tonight. Perhaps we should think about dragons at the school entrance."
"Hagrid would like that,"
said Dumbledore, smiling at Harry and Hermione. As he and Fudge left the dormitory, Madame Pomfrey hurried to the door and locked it again. Muttering angrily to herself, she headed back to her office. There was a low moan from the other end of the ward. Ron had woken up. They could see him sitting up, rubbing his head, looking around.
What happened?" he groaned. "Harry, why are we in here? Where's Sirius? Where's Lupin? What's going on?"
Harry and Hermione looked at each other. "You explain," said Harry, helping himself to some more chocolate. When Harry, Ron, and Hermione left the hospital wing at noon the next day, it was to find an almost deserted castle. The sweltering heat and the end of the exams meant that everyone was taking full advantage of another Hogsmeade visit. Neither Ron nor Hermione felt like going, however, so they and Harry wandered onto the grounds, still talking about the extraordinary events of the previous night and wondering where Sirius and Buckbeak were now. Sitting near the lake, watching the giant squid waving its tentacles lazily above the water, Harry lost the thread of the conversation as he looked across to the opposite bank. The stag had galloped toward him from there just last night. A shadow fell across them, and they looked up to see a very bleary-eyed Hagrid mopping his sweaty face with one of his tablecloth-size handkerchiefs and beaming down at them.
"No, I shouldn't feel happy after what happened last night," he said. "I mean, Black escaping again and everything. But guess what?"
"What?" they said, pretending to look curious.
"Beaky! He escaped! He's free! Been celebrating all night!"
"That's wonderful," said Hermione, giving Ron a reproving look, because he looked as though he was close to laughing.
"Yeah, can't have tied him up properly,"
said Hagrid, gazing happily out over the grounds.
"I was worried this morning, mind. Thought he might have met Professor Lupin on the grounds. But Lupin says he never ate anything last night."
"What?"
"Blimey, haven't you heard?"
said Hagrid, his smile fading a little. He lowered his voice, even though there was nobody in sight.
Snape told all the Slytherins this morning. Thought everyone would know by now. Professor Lupin's a werewolf, see? And he was loose on the grounds last night. He's packing now, of course."
"He's packing?" said Harry, alarmed. "Why?"
"Leaving, isn't he?"
said Hagrid, looking surprised that Harry had to ask.
"Resigned first thing this morning. Says he can't risk it happening again."
Harry scrambled to his feet. "I'm going to see him," he said to Ron and Hermione.
"But if he's resigned..."
"Doesn't sound like there's anything we can do."
"I don't care. I still want to see him. I'll meet you back here."
Lupin's office door was open. He had already packed most of his things. The Grindylow's empty tank stood next to his battered old suitcase, which was open and nearly full. Lupin was bending over something on his desk and looked up only when Harry knocked on the door.
"I saw you coming," said Lupin, smiling. He pointed to the parchment he had been poring over. It was the Marauder's map.
"I just saw Hagrid," said Harry, "and he said you'd resigned. It's not true, is it?"
"I'm afraid it is," said Lupin. He started opening his desk drawers and taking out the contents.
"Why," said Harry, "the Ministry of Magic don't think you were helping Sirius, do they?"
Lupin crossed to the door and closed it behind Harry.
"No, Professor Dumbledore managed to convince Fudge that I was trying to save your lives," he sighed. "That was the final straw for Severus. I think the loss of the Order of Merlin hit him hard. So he, accidentally let slip that I am a werewolf this morning at breakfast."
"You're not leaving just because of that?" said Harry. Lupin smiled wryly.
"This time tomorrow the owls will start arriving from parents. They will not want a werewolf teaching their children, Harry. And after last night I see their point. I could have bitten any of you. That must never happen again."
"You're the best defense against the dark arts teacher we've ever had," said Harry. "Don't go."
Lupin shook his head and didn't speak. He carried on emptying his drawers. Then, while Harry was trying to think of a good argument to make him stay, Lupin said,
"From what the headmaster told me this morning, you saved a lot of lives last night, Harry. If I'm proud of anything I've done this year, it's how much you've learned. Tell me about your Patronus."
"How do you know about that?" said Harry, distracted.
"What else could have driven the Dementors back?"
Harry told Lupin what had happened. When he'd finished, Lupin was smiling again.
"Yes, your father was always a stag when he transformed," he said. "You guessed right. That's why we called him Prongs."
Lupin threw his last books into his case, closed the desk drawers, and turned to look at Harry.
"Here, I bought this from the Shrieking Shack last night," he said, handing Harry back the invisibility cloak. "And..."
he hesitated, then held out the Marauder's map, too.
"I am no longer your teacher, so I don't feel guilty about giving you back this as well. It's no use to me, and I dare say you, Ron and Hermione, will find uses for it."
Harry took the map and grinned.
"You told me Moony, Wormtail, Padfoot, and Prongs would have wanted to lure me out of school. You said they'd have thought it was funny."
"And so we would have,"
said Lupin, now reaching down to close his case. "I have no hesitation in saying that James would have been highly disappointed if his son had never found any of the secret passages out of the castle." There was a knock on the door. Harry hastily stuffed the Marauder's map and the invisibility cloak into his pocket. It was Professor Dumbledore. He didn't look surprised to see Harry there.
"Your carriage is at the gates, Remus," he said.
"Thank you, Headmaster." Lupin picked up his old suitcase and the empty Grindelwald tank. "Well, goodbye, Harry," he said, smiling. "It has been a real pleasure teaching you. I feel sure we'll meet again sometime. Headmaster, there is no need to see me to the gates. I can manage." Harry had the impression that Lupin wanted to leave as quickly as possible.
"Goodbye, then, Remus," said Dumbledore soberly.
Lupin shifted the Grindelwald tank slightly so that he and Dumbledore could shake hands. Then, with a final nod to Harry and a swift smile, Lupin left the office. Harry sat down in his vacated chair, staring glumly at the floor. He heard the door close and looked up. Dumbledore was still there.
"Why so miserable, Harry?" he said quietly. "You should be very proud of yourself after last night."
"It didn't make any difference," said Harry bitterly. "Pettigrew got away."
"Didn't make any difference?" said Dumbledore quietly. "It made all the difference in the world, Harry. You helped uncover the truth. You saved an innocent man from a terrible fate."
Terrible? Something stirred in Harry's memory, greater and more terrible than ever before. Professor Trelawney's prediction. "Professor Dumbledore, yesterday, when I was having my divination exam, Professor Trelawney went very, very strange."
"Indeed," said Dumbledore.
Stranger than usual, you mean?" "Yes. Her voice went all deep and her eyes rolled, and she said Voldemort's servant was going to set out to return to him before midnight. She said the servant would help him come back to power." Harry stared up at Dumbledore. "And then she sort of became normal again, and she couldn't remember anything she said. Was she making a real prediction?" Dumbledore looked mildly impressed.
"Do you know, Harry, I think she might have been," he said thoughtfully. "Who'd have thought it? That brings her total of real predictions up to 2. I should offer her a pay raise."
"But," Harry looked at him aghast, "how could Dumbledore take this so calmly?"
"But I stopped Sirius and Professor Lupin from killing Pettigrew. That makes it my fault if Voldemort comes back."
"It does not," said Dumbledore quietly.
"Hasn't your experience with the time-turner taught you anything, Harry? The consequences of our actions are always so complicated, so diverse, that predicting the future is a very difficult business indeed. Professor Trelawney, bless her, is living proof of that. You did a very noble thing in saving Pettigrew's life."
"But if he helps Voldemort back to power..."
"Pettigrew owes his life to you. You have sent Voldemort a deputy who is in your debt. When one wizard saves another wizard's life, it creates a certain bond between them. And I'm much mistaken if Voldemort wants his servant in the debt of Harry Potter."
"I don't want a connection with Pettigrew," said Harry. "He betrayed my parents."
"This is magic at its deepest, its most impenetrable, Harry. But trust me, the time may come when you will be very glad you saved Pettigrew's life."
Harry couldn't imagine when that would be. Dumbledore looked as though he knew what Harry was thinking.
"I knew your father very well, both at Hogwarts and later, Harry," he said gently. "He would have saved Pettigrew too, I'm sure of it."
Harry looked up at him. Dumbledore wouldn't laugh. He could tell Dumbledore. "I thought it was my dad who'd conjured my Patronus. I mean, when I saw myself across the lake, I thought I was seeing him."
"An easy mistake to make," said Dumbledore softly. "I expect you'll tire of hearing it, but you do look extraordinarily like James. except for the eyes. You have your mother's eyes.
Harry shook his head. It was stupid, thinking it was him, he muttered. I mean, I knew he was dead.
You think the dead we loved ever truly leave us? You think that we don't recall them more clearly than ever in times of great trouble? Your father is alive in you, Harry, and shows himself most plainly when you have need of him. How else could you produce that particular Patronus? Prongs rode again last night.
It took a moment for Harry to realize what Dumbledore had said.
Last night, Sirius told me all about how they became animagi, said Dumbledore, smiling. An extraordinary achievement, not least keeping it quiet from me. And then I remembered the most unusual form your Patronus took when it charged Mr. Malfoy down at your Quidditch match against Ravenclaw. You know, Harry, in a way you did see your father last night. You found him inside yourself.
And Dumbledore left the office, leaving Harry to his very confused thoughts. Nobody at Hogwarts now knew the truth of what had happened that night, that Sirius, Buckbeak and Pettigrew had vanished, except Harry, Ron, Hermione and Professor Dumbledore. As the end of term approached, Harry heard many different theories about what had really happened, but none of them came close to the truth. Malfoy was furious about Buckbeak. He was convinced that Hagrid had found a way of smuggling the Hippogriff to safety, and seemed outraged that he and his father had been outwitted by a gamekeeper. Percy Weasley, meanwhile, had much to say on the subject of Sirius's escape. "If I manage to get into the Ministry, I'll have a lot of proposals to make about magical law enforcement," he told the only person who would listen, his girlfriend Penelope. Though the weather was perfect, though the atmosphere was so cheerful, though he knew they had achieved the near impossible in helping Sirius to freedom, Harry had never approached the end of a school year in worse spirits. He certainly wasn't the only one who was sorry to see Professor Lupin go. The whole of Harry's defense against the Dark Arts class was miserable about his resignation.
"Wonder what they'll give us next year," said Seamus Finnegan gloomily.
"Maybe a vampire,"
suggested Dean Thomas hopefully. It wasn't only Professor Lupin's departure that was weighing on Harry's mind. He couldn't help thinking a lot about Professor Trelawney's prediction. He kept wondering where Pettigrew was now, whether he had sought sanctuary with Voldemort yet. But the thing that was lowering Harry's spirits most of all was the prospect of returning to the Dursleys. For maybe half an hour, a glorious half hour, he had believed he would be living with Sirius from now on, his parents' best friend. It would have been the next best thing to having his own father back. And while no news of Sirius was definitely good news, because it meant he had successfully gone into hiding, Harry couldn't help feeling miserable when he thought of the home he might have had, and the fact that it was now impossible. The exam results came out on the last day of term. Harry, Ron, and Hermione had passed every subject. Harry was amazed that he had got through potions. He had a shrewd suspicion that Dumbledore might have stepped in to stop Snape failing him on purpose. Snape's behavior toward Harry over the past week had been quite alarming. Harry wouldn't have thought it possible that Snape's dislike for him could increase, but it certainly had. A muscle twitched unpleasantly at the corner of Snape's thin mouth every time he looked at Harry, and he was constantly flexing his fingers as though itching to place them around Harry's throat. Percy had got his top-grade N.E.W.T.s. Fred and George had scraped a handful of O.W.L.s each. Gryffindor House, meanwhile, largely thanks to their spectacular performance in the Quidditch Cup, had won the House Championship for the third year running. This meant that the end-of-term feast took place amid decorations of scarlet and gold, and that the Gryffindor table was the noisiest of the lot, as everybody celebrated. Even Harry managed to forget about the journey back to the Dursleys the next day as he ate, drank, talked, and laughed with the rest. As the Hogwarts Express pulled out of the station the next morning, Hermione gave Harry and Ron some surprising news.
I went to see Professor McGonagall this morning, just before breakfast. I've decided to drop Muggle studies.
But you passed your exam with 320%, said Ron.
I know, sighed Hermione, but I can't stand another year like this one. That time turner, it was driving me mad. I've handed it in. Without Muggle studies and divination, I'll be able to have a normal schedule again.
I still can't believe you didn't tell us about it, said Ron grumpily. We're supposed to be your friends.
I promised I wouldn't tell anyone, said Hermione severely.
She looked around at Harry, who was watching Hogwarts disappear from view behind a mountain. 2 whole months before he'd see it again.
Oh, cheer up, Harry, said Hermione sadly. I'm okay, said Harry quickly, just thinking about the holidays.
Yeah, I've been thinking about them too, said Ron. Harry, you've got to come and stay with us. I'll fix it up with Mum and Dad, and then I'll call you. I know how to use a Felitone now.
A telephone, Ron, said Hermione. Honestly, you should take Muggle studies next year.
Ron ignored her.
It's the Quidditch World Cup this summer. How about it, Harry? Come and stay, and we'll go and see it. Dad can usually get tickets from work.
This proposal had the effect of cheering Harry up a great deal.
Yeah. I bet the Dursleys would be pleased to let me come, especially after what I did to Aunt Marge.
Feeling considerably more cheerful, Harry joined Ron and Hermione in several games of exploding snap, and when the witch with the tea cart arrived, he bought himself a very large lunch, though nothing with chocolate in it. But it was late in the afternoon before the thing that made him truly happy turned up.
"Harry," said Hermione suddenly, peering over his shoulder, "what's that thing outside your window?"
Harry turned to look outside. Something very small and grey was bobbing in and out of sight beyond the glass. He stood up for a better look and saw that it was a tiny owl, carrying a letter that was much too big for it. The owl was so small, in fact, that it kept tumbling over in the air, buffeted this way and that in the train's slipstream. Harry quickly pulled down the window, stretched out his arm, and caught it. It felt like a very fluffy snitch. He brought it carefully inside. The owl dropped its letter onto Harry's seat and began zooming around their compartment, apparently very pleased with itself for accomplishing its task. Hedwig clicked her beak with a sort of dignified disapproval. Crookshank sat up in his seat, following the owl with his great yellow eyes. Ron, noticing this, snatched the owl safely out of harm's way. Harry picked up the letter. It was addressed to him. He ripped open the letter and shouted,
"It's from Sirius!"
"What?" said Ron and Hermione excitedly. "Read it aloud."
"Dear Harry, I hope this finds you before you reach your aunt and uncle. I don't know whether they're used to owl post. Buckbeak and I are in hiding. I won't tell you where, in case this owl falls into the wrong hands. I have some doubt about his reliability, but he is the best I could find, and he did seem eager for the job. I believe the Dementors are still searching for me, but they haven't a hope of finding me here. I am planning to allow some Muggles to glimpse me soon, a long way from Hogwarts, so that the security on the castle will be lifted. There is something I never got around to telling you during our brief meeting. It was I who sent you the firebolt."
"Ha!" said Hermione triumphantly. "See? I told you it was from him."
"Yes, but he hadn't jinxed it, had he?" said Ron. "Ouch!"
The tiny owl, now hooting happily in his hand, had nibbled one of his fingers in what it seemed to think was an affectionate way. "Crookshanks took the order to the owl office for me. I used your name, but told them to take the gold from my own Gringotts vault. Please consider it as 13 birthdays worth of presents from your godfather. I would also like to apologize for the fright I think I gave you that night last year when you left your uncle's house. I had only hoped to get a glimpse of you before starting my journey north, but I think the sight of me alarmed you. I am enclosing something else for you which I think will make your next year at Hogwarts more enjoyable. If ever you need me, send word. Your owl will find me. I'll write again soon. Sirius." Harry looked eagerly inside the envelope. There was another piece of parchment in there. He read it through quickly, and felt suddenly as warm and contented as though he'd swallowed a bottle of hot butter beer in one gulp. "I, Sirius Black,
Harry Potter's godfather, hereby give him permission to visit Hogsmeade on weekends.
"That'll be good enough for Dumbledore," said Harry happily. He looked back at Sirius's letter.
"Hang on, there's a P.S. I thought your friend Ron might like to keep this owl, as it's my fault he no longer has a rat." Ron's eyes widened. The minute owl was still hooting excitedly.
"Keep him?"
he said uncertainly. He looked closely at the owl for a moment. Then, to Harry's and Hermione's great surprise, he held him out for Crookshanks to sniff.
"What do you reckon?" Ron asked the cat. "Definitely an owl."
Crookshanks purred.
"That's good enough for me," said Ron happily. "He's mine."
Harry read and reread the letter from Sirius all the way back into King's Cross Station. It was still clutched tightly in his hand as he, Ron, and Hermione stepped back through the barrier of Platform 9 3/4. Harry spotted Uncle Vernon at once. He was standing a good distance from Mr. and Mrs. Weasley, eyeing them suspiciously, and when Mrs. Weasley hugged Harry in greeting, his worst suspicions about them seemed confirmed.
"I'll call about the World Cup,"
Ron yelled after Harry as Harry bid him and Hermione goodbye, then wheeled the trolley bearing his trunk and Hedwig's cage toward Uncle Vernon, who greeted him in his usual fashion.
"What's that?"
he snarled, staring at the envelope Harry was still clutching in his hand.
"If it's another form for me to sign, you've got another—"
"It's not," said Harry cheerfully. "It's a letter from my godfather."
"Godfather?" sputtered Uncle Vernon. "You haven't got a godfather."
"Yes, I have," said Harry brightly. "He was my mum and dad's best friend. He's a convicted murderer, but he's broken out of wizard prison and he's on the run. He likes to keep in touch with me, though, keep up with my news, check if I'm happy."
And, grinning broadly at the look of horror on Uncle Vernon's face, Harry set off toward the station exit, Hedwig rattling along in front of him for what looked like a much better summer than the last.
Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban was read by Jim Dale. Text copyright J.K. Rowling 1999. Recording copyright Listening Library 1999. An imprint of the Penguin Random House Audio Publishing Group. Digitally remastered by Pottermore at Pinewood Studios in 2015. Pottermore is the digital entertainment, news and e-commerce company from J.K. Rowling, inspired by her Harry Potter books and the wider wizarding world. Pottermore is a place for Harry Potter fans to be entertained and discover more of the wizarding world they love through Pottermore.com experiences or products including Harry Potter ebooks, digital audiobooks, and more. Harry Potter characters, names, and related indicia are trademarks and copyright of Warner Brothers Entertainment. The story continues. Find out what happens next in this preview of the digital audiobook Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire by J.K. Rowling. Text copyright J.K. Rowling 2000. Recording copyright Listening Library 2000. An imprint of the Penguin Random House Audio Publishing Group.
Chapter 1. The Riddle House. The villagers of Little Haggleton still called it the Riddle House, even though it had been many years since the Riddle family had lived there. It stood on a hill overlooking the village, some of its windows boarded, tiles missing from its roof, and ivy spreading unchecked over its face. Once a fine-looking manor, and easily the largest and grandest building for miles around, the Riddle House was now damp, derelict, and unoccupied. The little Hangletons all agreed that the old house was creepy. Half a century ago, something strange and horrible had happened there, something that the older inhabitants of the village still liked to discuss when topics for gossip were scarce. The story had been picked over so many times and had been embroidered in so many places that nobody was quite sure what the truth was any more. Every version of the tale, however, started in the same place. 50 years before, at daybreak on a fine summer's morning, when the Riddle House had still been well kept and impressive, a maid had entered the drawing room to find all three Riddles dead. The maid had run screaming down the hill into the village and roused as many people as she could.
"Lying there with her eyes wide open, cold as ice, still in their dinner things."
The police were summoned, and the whole of Little Hangleton had seethed with shock curiosity and ill-disguised excitement. Nobody wasted their breath pretending to feel very sad about the Riddles, for they had been most unpopular. Elderly Mr. and Mrs. Riddle had been rich, snobbish, and rude, and their grown-up son Tom had been, if anything, worse. All the villagers cared about was the identity of their murderer, for plainly, three apparently healthy people did not all drop dead of natural causes on the same night. The hanged man, the village pub, did a roaring trade that night. The whole village seemed to have turned out to discuss the murders. They were rewarded for leaving their firesides when the Riddles cook arrived dramatically in their midst and announced to the suddenly silent pub that a man called Frank Bryce had just been arrested.
"Frank?" cried several people. "Never!"
Frank Bryce was the Riddles' gardener. He lived alone in a run-down cottage on the grounds of the Riddle house. Frank had come back from the war with a very stiff leg and a great dislike of crowds and loud noises, and had been working for the Riddles ever since. There was a rush to buy the cook drinks and hear more details.
"Always thought he was odd,"
she told the eagerly listening villagers after her fourth sherry.
"Unfriendly, like. I'm sure if I've offered him a cuppa once, I've offered it 100 times. Never wanted to mix, he didn't."
"Ah, no,"
said a woman at the bar.
"He had a hard war, Frank. He likes the quiet life. That's no reason to..."
"Who else had a key to the back door, then?"
barked the cook.
"There's been a spare key hanging in the gardener's cottage far back as I can remember. Nobody forced the door last night. No broken windows. All Frank had to do was creep up to the big house while we was all sleeping."
The villagers exchanged dark looks.
"I always thought he had a nasty look about him, right enough,"
grunted a man at the bar.
"War turned him funny, if you ask me," said the landlord.
"Told you I wouldn't like to get on the wrong side of Frank, didn't I, Dot?"
said an excited woman in the corner.
"Horrible temper,"
said Dot, nodding fervently.
"I remember when he was a kid."
By the following morning, hardly anyone in Little Hangleton doubted that Frank Bryce had killed the Riddles. But over in the neighbouring town of Great Hangleton, in the dark and dingy police station, Frank was stubbornly repeating again and again that he was innocent, and that the only person he had seen near the house on the day of the Riddles' deaths had been a teenage boy, a stranger, dark-haired and pale. Nobody else in the village had seen any such boy, and the police were quite sure that Frank had invented him. Then, just when things were looking very serious for Frank, the report on the Riddles' bodies came back and changed everything. The police had never read an odder report. A team of doctors had examined the bodies and had concluded that none of the Riddles had been poisoned, stabbed, shot, strangled, suffocated, or, as far as they could tell, harmed at all. In fact, the report continued in a tone of unmistakable bewilderment, the Riddles all appeared to be in perfect health, apart from the fact that they were all dead. The doctors did note, as though determined to find something wrong with the bodies, that each of the Riddles had a look of terror upon his or her face. But, as the frustrated police said, whoever heard of three people being frightened to death? As there was no proof that the Riddles had been murdered at all, the police were forced to let Frank go. The Riddles were buried in the Little Hangleton churchyard, and their graves remained objects of curiosity for a while. To everyone's surprise and amid a cloud of suspicion, Frank Bryce returned to his cottage on the grounds of the Riddle house.
"So far as I'm concerned, he killed them, and I don't care what the police say,"
said Dot in The Hanged Man.
"And if he had any decency, he'd leave here, knowing as how we knows he did it."
But Frank did not leave. He stayed to tend the garden for the next family who lived in the Riddle house, and then the next, for neither family stayed long. Perhaps it was partly because of Frank that the new owners said there was a nasty feeling about the place, which, in the absence of inhabitants, started to fall into disrepair. The wealthy man who owned the Riddle house these days neither lived there nor put it to any use. They said in the village that he kept it for tax reasons, though nobody was very clear what these might be.
The wealthy owner continued to pay Frank to do the gardening, however. Frank was nearing his 77th birthday now, very deaf, his bad leg stiffer than ever, but could be seen pottering around the flower beds in fine weather, even though the weeds were starting to creep up on him, try as he might to suppress them. Weeds were not the only things Frank had to contend with, either. Boys from the village made a habit of throwing stones through the windows of the Riddle house. They rode their bicycles over the lawns Frank worked so hard to keep smooth. Once or twice they broke into the old house for a dare. They knew that old Frank's devotion to the house and grounds amounted almost to an obsession, and it amused them to see him limping across the garden, brandishing his stick and yelling croakily at them. Frank, for his part, believed the boys tormented him because they, like their parents and grandparents, thought him a murderer. So when Frank awoke one night in August and saw something very odd up at the old house, he merely assumed that the boys had gone one step further in their attempts to punish him. It was Frank's bad leg that woke him. It was paining him worse than ever in his old age. He got up and limped downstairs into the kitchen, with the idea of refilling his hot water bottle to ease the stiffness in his knee. Standing at the sink, filling the kettle, he looked up at the Riddle house and saw lights glimmering in its upper windows. Frank knew at once what was going on. The boys had broken into the house again, and judging by the flickering quality of the light, they had started a fire. Frank had no telephone, and in any case he had deeply mistrusted the police ever since they had taken him in for questioning about the Riddles' deaths. He put down the kettle at once, hurried back upstairs as fast as his bad leg would allow, and was soon back in his kitchen, fully dressed and removing a rusty old key from its hook by the door. He picked up his walking stick, which was propped against the wall, and set off into the night. The front door of the Riddle house bore no sign of being forced, nor did any of the windows. Frank limped around to the back of the house until he reached a door almost completely hidden by ivy, took out the old key, put it into the lock, and opened the door noiselessly. He let himself into the cavernous kitchen. Frank had not entered it for many years. Nevertheless, although it was very dark, he remembered where the door into the hall was, and he groped his way toward it, his nostrils full of the smell of decay, ears pricked for any sound of footsteps or voices from overhead. He reached the hall, which was a little lighter owing to the large mullioned windows on either side of the front door, and started to climb the stairs, blessing the dust that lay thick upon the stone, because it muffled the sound of his feet and stick. On the landing, Frank turned right and saw at once where the intruders were. At the very end of the passage a door stood ajar, and a flickering light shone through the gap, casting a long sliver of gold across the black floor. Frank edged closer and closer, grasping his walking stick firmly. Several feet from the entrance, he was able to see a narrow slice of the room beyond. The fire, he now saw, had been lit in the grate. This surprised him. Then he stopped moving and listened intently, for a man's voice spoke within the room. It sounded timid and fearful.
"There is a little more in the bottle, my lord, if you are still hungry."
"Later,"
said a second voice. This, too, belonged to a man, but it was strangely high-pitched and cold as a sudden blast of icy wind. Something about that voice made the sparse hairs on the back of Frank's neck stand up.
"Move me closer to the fire, Wormtail."
Frank turned his right ear toward the door, the better to hear. There came the clink of a bottle being put down upon some hard surface, and then the dull, scraping noise of a heavy chair being dragged across the floor. Frank caught a glimpse of a small man, his back to the door, pushing the chair into place. He was wearing a long black cloak, and there was a bald patch at the back of his head. Then he went out of sight again.
"Where is Nagini?"
said the cold voice.
I don't know, my lord,"
said the first voice nervously.
"She set out to explore the house, I think."
"You will milk her before we retire, Wormtail,"
said the second voice.
"I will need feeding in the night. The journey has tired me greatly."
Brow furrowed, Frank inclined his good ear still closer to the door, listening very hard. There was a pause, and then the man called Wormtail spoke again.
"My lord, may I ask how long we are going to stay here?"
"A week,"
said the cold voice.
"Perhaps longer. The place is moderately comfortable, and the plan cannot proceed yet. It would be foolish to act before the Quidditch World Cup is over.
Frank inserted a gnarled finger into his ear and rotated it. Owing no doubt to a build-up of earwax, he had heard the word Quidditch, which was not a word at all.